Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nigel Adderley, and in the early hours of Friday, the 29th of December, these are our main stories. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro ups the ante by ordering military exercises on the country's eastern Caribbean and Atlantic coasts in an escalation of a territorial dispute with Guyana.
I have ordered the activation of a joint action of the entire Bolivarian National Military Force of a defensive nature.
Also, why the Mexican authorities won't be punishing residents of a town who killed 10 members of a drugs cartel. And a court in Qatar commutes the death sentences of 8 Indians reportedly accused of espionage. Also in this podcast, a special report on whether the change of government in Brazil has helped the Amazon rainforest and its people. And
I think what many people find surprising is that many of the trends, I think, that they would assume to be going in the wrong direction are actually going in the right direction.
Why the world may not be quite as bad as we think it is. The Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, has ordered military exercises on the country's eastern Caribbean and Atlantic coast in response to a British decision to send a warship to support neighbouring Guyana. The UK government took the decision after Venezuela renewed its claim to an oil-rich area which makes up about two-thirds of neighbouring Guyana's territory. Mr. Maduro made the announcement on television.
I have ordered the activation of a joint action of the entire Bolivarian National Military Force, a joint action of a defensive nature in response to the provocation and threat of the United Kingdom against the peace and sovereignty of our country.
Nicolas Maduro. A recent controversial referendum suggested that 95% of voters were in favour of establishing a new Venezuelan state in the territory. The BBC's Will Grant reports.
In a televised meeting of Venezuela's joint military chiefs, President Maduro called the deployment of the British warship HMS Trent off Guyana's coast practically a military threat by London. It was, he added, against the spirit of a non-aggression agreement reached between Caracas and Georgetown earlier this month. President Maduro then immediately ordered what he called a joint defensive action off the coast of the disputed region by the country's armed forces. He was told by the assembled military leaders that 5,600 personnel were ready to be deployed. On sending HMS Trent to the Guyanese coast, the UK Defence Ministry issued a statement saying it was part of a wider series of exercises in the region. However, in an emergency meeting in St Vincent and the Grenadines 2 weeks ago, Guyana and Venezuela had agreed to avoid the use of force over their decades-long border dispute. The argument over the oil-rich Essequibo region has been significantly ratcheted up in recent weeks after a referendum in Venezuela called for Venezuelan sovereignty to be asserted over it. Guyana has repeatedly said the dispute must be solved through the International Court of Justice, while Mr. Maduro's critics have dismissed his actions as further saber-rattling ahead of a presidential election next year.
Will Grant. There's been yet another mass movement of Palestinians in Gaza, where civilians are trying to escape some of the fiercest fighting in a war in one of the most densely populated places in the world. The United Nations Relief Agency said there were 150,000 people being forcibly displaced by Israel from the centre of the Strip, where there's a large-scale ground advance against Hamas. Israel insists its evacuation orders have been issued to protect civilians. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Shaima Khalil, told me about the next phase of Israel's operation to eradicate Hamas.
It's a continuation of the massive ground offensive that we'd seen in northern Gaza over the past couple of months, actually. The Israeli military has said that they have near full control of the north, although it is still continuing their operations, but now they're moving to central Gaza. The main area that they're talking about is three refugee camps, Al-Nusrat, Burej, and Al-Maghazi camp. in the southern city of Khan Yunis, it's been again suffering heavy bombardment. There's also been a ground operation, and we've also had reports of bombardment in Rafah in the past 2 days further south. As this ground operation intensifies and deepens, Gazans themselves, including babies and disabled people and young children, they're running out of places to flee to find safety.
And according to the Hamas-run health ministry, 70 people were killed in the Maghazi refugee camp. Israel has carried out an inquiry. And how rare is it for Israel to express regret like this?
I haven't heard it expressed in that way, let's just say that. This happened on December the 24th, late at night. It was an airstrike that hit a number of buildings in a heavily populated residential block. We're now hearing from the Hamas-run health ministry that the number is actually 86. And they always said that the number is going to rise because bodies are still being pulled from the rubble. The Israeli military have said that they hit two targets adjacent to where Hamas militants were operating, and a preliminary inquiry showed that further buildings nearby were hit and that this likely caused unintended harm to additional uninvolved civilians. But yes, they expressed regret and they said they're drawing conclusions and learning lessons from the incident.
Shaima Khalil. According to Israel, around 130 hostages who were kidnapped by Hamas during the 7th of October attacks are still in Gaza. There were further demonstrations in Jerusalem on Thursday, with protesters calling on the government to ensure their release.
I'm from Kibbutz Kfar Aza, and my people were kidnapped. We want them back.
One of the chants earlier, they were listing off names, and then I realised that one of the girls said, bring back dad, instead of one of the names, and that hit really deep.
The BBC and other Western news organisations can't enter Gaza and report freely because Israel tightly controls its access. But they have given some journalists the rare chance to travel with the army into northern Gaza. Kazra Naji from BBC Persian has just returned from being allowed inside what Israel said was the largest tunnel it had discovered so far, which is part of a huge underground network controlled by Hamas. He told me what it was like.
From a short distance away, it doesn't look like a great discovery or a massive engineering feat. They found the mouth of the tunnel in a sand dune, so you have to go down to get to the mouth of the tunnel. And when you do get inside, it's impressive. It's big, you can drive a car through it, it's made of concrete, it's electrified, it's got all sorts of wires for electricity and other amenities. And at first, it goes down at a slope for about 50 meters deep, and then the tunnel becomes a horizontal sort of a stretch with the other side opening onto northern part of the city of Gaza. But we couldn't go further than 20, 30 meters because the Israeli army said that it might not be safe. And when we were there, it was dark in the tunnel, of course. We had these soldiers looking at the dark end of the tunnel with their machine guns and their fingers on the trigger, holding torchlights as if, you know, they expected Hamas type to come out at any point from the darkness. It still is not totally secure because I talked to a spokesman for the army, and they said because this tunnel has entrances from other tunnels, it's part of a bigger network, there may be entrances that we have missed, and we are being very cautious. I also talked to a Israeli officer who is originally Iranian, and he spoke to me in Persian. He was telling me that this tunnel, you can live, you can sleep, you can have a bath, you can go to the toilet, you can even hold prisoners here for years without anybody from above noticing. He was referring to Israeli, of course, drones that are flying all the time over Gaza. And he was saying that we knew about this tunnel, but we didn't know how big it was because from above, you can only see so much.
And how key do the Israelis believe that these tunnels have been to the way that Hamas have fought this war?
It looks as if the military ground incursion into Gaza is going a lot slower than expected and is producing a lot of problems for Israelis. And one reason for that is these very tunnels that stretch throughout Gaza Strip. And obviously they're using these tunnels to hide in, come out, attack and go back into the tunnels and hide. So it's becoming more and more difficult for Israelis to get further in their plan plan to clear these areas of Hamas and Islamic Jihad militants. It looks to me that these tunnels are becoming a major issue for their military progress.
Katherine Nashi. 3 weeks ago, members of a drug cartel arrived in a town in central Mexico to collect protection money from a group of local farmers. This is what happened next. Footage shows dozens of people, some wearing cowboy hats, attacking the gang members. 14 people were killed, 10 of them members of the cartel, the Familia Michoacana. A police investigation was carried out, but now state prosecutors have decided that the farmers acted in self-defence and won't face any charges. Our Latin America and Caribbean editor, Vanessa Buschutler, told me about the Michoacana cartel.
It's a gang that has been active for almost 20 years, and its heyday was about 10, 15 years ago. It has since splintered, but it still holds sway in rural areas in Michoacán, which is the state that it's named after, and also in Mexico State, which is where this village is located, Texcapilla, where this horrible incident happened 3 weeks ago.
And how common is it for those facing extortion from cartels to take matters into their own hands like this?
It is not very common because of the horrible reprisals that tend to happen. These gangs are heavily armed, so anyone standing up to them knows that they could face death. In this case, it was very unusual because the locals managed to kill 10 of the gang members, including one of the leaders of the gang, who goes by the name of El Payaso, meaning the clown in Spanish.
The footage does show an incredibly violent battle, and I suppose from the farmers' point of view, they were incredibly brave.
Absolutely, especially if you then find out, as we have since from the prosecutor's office, that the weapons that the farmers wielded were, I quote, tools of their trade. So it was machetes, scythes, some shotguns, but not the kind of arms that the cartel would have wielded. So very brave indeed. But it has to be said, there have been reprisals since. 14 local people have been abducted, and it is presumed that these people were seized by this gang as a reprisal in revenge for what happened on that day.
Vanessa Buschutler. 12 Chinese military aircraft were detected off Taiwan on Thursday, and now the government there has accused China of mounting a huge misinformation campaign to try and influence the island's presidential election, which takes place in just over 2 weeks' time. China views Taiwan as a breakaway province that will eventually come under Beijing's control. It's accused Taipei of trying to stoke confrontation and manipulate the election. Taiwan's ruling Democratic Progressive Party is hoping to win an unprecedented third presidential term. As our Taiwan correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes reports, it's not just political pressure that China is exerting.
It's 6 a.m. at a fighter base on the west coast of Taiwan. Three sleek Mirage fighter jets are on the taxiway. They're from Taiwan's Rapid Reaction Squadron, tasked with meeting any incoming threat to the island's airspace. Seconds later, the brakes are released and they roar down the runway.
These Taiwanese fighter jets being scrambled here are heading out into the Taiwan Strait to confront Chinese aircraft that are coming across the strait and probing Taiwan's airspace. This is now happening multiple times every day.
In any single day, China now regularly sends 10 or more aircraft across the median line that divides the Taiwan Strait. But when Beijing wants to turn up the tension, it can send scores of aircraft. On one day in September, there were over 100. And it's not just in the air. On a hill on the southern tip of Taiwan, Navy veteran Xu Gengrei is setting up a 5-metre-long radio antenna. Xu tunes his set to the channel used by Taiwan's Navy and Coast Guard. Within minutes, we pick up a transmission from the Chinese Navy.
That's the Chinese Navy talking to the Taiwanese Navy, saying your territorial waters do not exist, that the People's Republic of China is the only legitimate government of China, and that Taiwan is an inseparable part of China.
At his home in Taipei, I meet up with Admiral Li Shimin. Until 2019, Admiral Lee was the commander of Taiwan's armed forces. He says China's so-called grey zone warfare tactics have multiple aims. One is to intimidate the island's voters. Another is to send a warning to Taiwan's allies.
I think China is sending a very strong signal to the United States that Taiwan is part of China. But in the meantime, they can use this kind of aggression to make Taiwanese people scared and make Taiwanese people capitulate.
People are increasingly worried about the threat. But at this election rally in Taipei, I found supporters of the frontrunner to win Taiwan's presidency in defiant mood.
I'm very worried, but I'm not afraid, because I will be volunteer to be a soldier, defend our beautiful country.
I'm worried about this, but if someday we may be war, I'm not afraid, because I think I'm Taiwanese, I need to protect my country.
Back on the coast, the jets are returning from their morning patrol. Another aim of China's grey zone warfare is to wear out Taiwan's small fleet of modern military jets and to exhaust its pilots. And experts say that may be working. Taiwan has fewer than 300 jets. China has more than 2,000. Whoever becomes Taiwan's next president will face a military balance tipping ever more in China's favour.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes. If you listen to or watch the news on a regular basis, you could be forgiven for thinking the world is a bleak place with the current conflicts, climate change, and the threat posed by artificial intelligence. But the data doesn't always back that up. Dr. Hannah Ritchie is the deputy editor of the online publication Our World in Data. Vivia Nunes spoke to her about her new book, Not the End of the World. It's been published next month, and in it she argues that if we really look closely at the data, the world starts to look a little brighter.
The headlines, they tend to be quite eye-grabbing events, and those tend to be negative. So it's a disaster, a war, a recession. So if we're trying to build a worldview purely based on what we see in the news, I think it would tend more negative than what the data would actually show. But you can't truly build up a picture of what's happening to 8 billion people around the world just based on small stories alone. And I think what many people find surprising is that many of the trends, I think, that they would assume to be going in the wrong direction are actually going in the right direction.
Yeah, so tell us some examples where what we think we know is quite far removed from what the data tells us.
One is extreme poverty. If you ask people how is extreme poverty around the world changing, they assume that it's going up. But if you go back to, say, 1820, around 80% of the world lived in extreme poverty. Now, over the last few centuries, we've seen a dramatic decline such that it's now less than 10%, which is obviously still far too high. But we have seen this dramatic decline and improvement across the world in extreme poverty. I think another example there is, and this is from my background as an environmentalist, I think when we look at the news media, we assume that there must be the most people dying from extreme weather and disasters. But when you look at the long-term data on this, say over the last century, we've seen a significant decline in deaths from disasters. Now, that's not because climate change isn't real or that disasters aren't intensifying. It's because we've become much more resilient to them. And part of this comes into the poverty story, where as we've got richer, as we've developed technologies, say early warning systems and more resilient infrastructure, we've managed to decrease deaths from disasters despite there being more intense. I think it's very clear from the data that we're moving far too slowly on climate change and we need to accelerate. But I think there are some good news stories in there. And I think when we come to talk about climate change, I think we need to stress the urgency and scale of the problem. But I think we also need to put emphasis on the solutions. If we only communicate how bad things are, then people become paralysed and we need to show people solutions. I mean, for example, in rich countries, we've seen a significant decline in emissions over the last few decades. So in the UK, most of our electricity used to come from coal, and we're now essentially coal-free. And I think really positive trends that we've seen in particular is the plummeting cost of low-carbon technologies, such that solar or wind are now cheaper than fossil fuels.
I guess from your point of view, it's encouraging media organisations, including the BBC, to take a more data-rich approach to reporting the world around us. How do you encourage journalists and media organisations to do that?
I think journalism will always be based around stories and headlines. I think that's what many people come to the news for. But what I also think it's important is to try and to give some context around those problems. So if there's a disaster in a particular region, it's useful to use the data to give context. Is this common? How common is it? Is this disaster worse than in the past? And also stress what the solutions to that are. So one is trying to address climate change, obviously, but there are also solutions on the adaptation and resilience side, such that people get a much more complete picture of what's going on. And it's not just an isolated event that they're seeing in the news.
Dr. Hannah Ritchie speaking to Vivian Nunes. Still to come on the Global News Podcast.
58 beetles, 4 crabs, some worms that eat whale bones, and the largest penguin that ever lived. Weighed 150 kilograms, 3 times the weight of the current largest penguin.
We hear about a bumper year for discoveries of new species around the world. Church leaders in the Democratic Republic of Congo say they found numerous cases of irregularities during the recent elections, which were extended over several days because of administrative chaos. At a news conference in Kinshasa, an election observation mission run by the Catholic and Protestant churches also raised questions about the legality of the shambolic voting process. Here's our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton.
The Catholic Protestant Observer Mission said there'd been numerous cases of irregularities which were likely to have affected the integrity of the results. Voting was officially extended by a day to account for logistical problems, but continued for days afterwards in some remote areas. In its preliminary report, the Observer Mission suggested that officially extending the vote by one day contravened electoral laws. Partial results released from the Electoral Commission showed the incumbent, President Félix Tshisekedi, as well ahead, with nearly 80% of the ballots counted so far.
Richard Hamilton. Now to a case that's made front-page headlines in India. Back in October, a court in Qatar sentenced 8 Indian former naval officers to death. The specific charges laid against them weren't revealed, but reports in the Indian media after their arrest last year suggested they were suspected of spying for Israel. Now their death sentences have been commuted. Our South Asia correspondent Ambarasa Natarajan gave me more details from Delhi.
They were working for a private security company and they were working closely with the Qatari Defence Forces. In August 2022, according to some of these family members, they were arrested and taken by the Qatari forces. And for a long time, many people did not know what happened to them. Even now, neither the Qatari officials nor the Indian authorities have clearly spelled out what the charges were. But they were kept in prison when they went to the court in April this year. And in October, the court gave the death penalty for all of them. That really shook many people here in India, because people did not know what the charges were. So there were a lot of speculations, and one of them being they were spying for Israel. But we don't know. These were only floating around in the media. So because Indian government is like growing in terms of stature around the world in the economy, people were taken by surprise how come a Gulf nation was able to arrest these people and why the government was not providing consular access. But according to what the government is saying, the Indian Prime Minister Modi met the Qatari Emir in a recent conference, and that really set the ball rolling. And now the Indian Foreign Ministry says that the death sentence have been commuted. But again, they do not know the full judgment and they don't want to comment at this point.
Ambarasa Natarajan. A Michelin-starred chef has left his job at a 5-star hotel in southwestern France, where a kitchen worker was reportedly abused in an initiation ritual. Aurélien Largeau ran the gourmet restaurant at the Hôtel du Palais in Biarritz. Our Europe regional editor Danny Eberhard has more details.
La Table d'Aurélien Largeau sits right on Biarritz's famous Atlantic beach. It offers diners, in its words, a unique experience in which they can savour sophisticated and contemporary French cuisine. But the chef it's named after has moved on. Local media have linked this to an incident earlier this month. It said footage that appeared temporarily online showed a kitchen hand tied up naked to a chair, humiliated while others looked on. The BBC has not seen it. The Hyatt, which runs the Hotel du Palais, said its management had investigated what it called concerning allegations and imagery of an incident that did not, as it put it, reflect the strong values it stands for. It said appropriate decisions had been taken without specifying what. The BBC has tried to contact Aurélien Lajot, who was named as one of the greats of tomorrow by the French gastronomic guide Go et Mio, for comment. He's told French media that reports of the incident are defamatory, describing them as a monstrous attack on his honour. Prosecutors have opened a preliminary investigation into possible violence and sexual abuse, but stress that, so far at least, they have not received a formal complaint.
Danny Eberhard. The Amazon is famously described as the lungs of the world. In the past year, deforestation in Brazil's rainforests has fallen dramatically. Plenty of work has been done to try and protect them since President Lula da Silva was elected. Under his predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro, it was a different story. The far-right president sought to develop the world's biggest rainforest at the expense of the environment. But now, with Lula in power, has the threat towards the Amazon and its people gone away or at least receded? Our South America correspondent Katie Watson has been finding out.
Nossa floresta é úmida.
Brazil's rainforest has been through some difficult years of late. Under former leader Jair Bolsonaro, deforestation soared to a 15-year high. He gave the green light to loggers and ranchers, who cleared vast swathes of land by setting fire to it. In August 2019, I saw it for myself, thousands of miles away in São Paulo. The smoke from the Amazon descended, turning the city dark. Fast forward to 2022, and Lula da Silva was very clear when he ran for president that things needed to change. We need to look after our forest, he told those of us who followed him to the Amazon's largest city, Manaus, on the campaign trail. But he added, more than that, we need to look after our people in the forest because they're suffering and they need to live a dignified life. And this year, Brazil took its largest ever delegation to COP28 in the United Arab Emirates. In 2025, it'll be bringing the event to the Amazon itself. But Lula's come in for some criticism here in Brazil because of his insistence in exploring for more oil, despite his rhetoric of saving the rainforest and its people. Raquel Tupinambá is an indigenous activist from the Tapajós region of the Amazon, who is at COP herself.
President Lula defends some economic activities that represent the death of territories and their people, like oil and gas exploration, within the territory or very close to indigenous people here in the Amazon.
But, says fellow community activist Leticia Santiago, the president is up against some formidable challenges.
There are political games and interests. Beyond Lula, we also have a very powerful rural lobby within the Senate, which has made life very difficult for environmental people to move forward.
I've come to the capital, Brasilia.
I'm here to meet Brazil's first indigenous minister, Sonia Guajajara.
What do you say to the young activists who feel they've got a lot of work to do and perhaps it's too late?
They need to keep fighting. I arrived here in this position to fight this fight. I continue with the same arguments. Young people can play the role of mobilizer, of articulator, and defend the future.
The world is watching Brazil with Lula's narrative of saving the forest. But after it hosts COP and the spotlight goes away, what then? Activist Valesca Queiroz is from the coastal Amazon city of Belém, where Brazil's COP is going to be held.
What will remain for the people after the event finishes? Given all the problems facing our city in the Amazon, I hope is a way of showing the power that we have and understanding that power.
The power of the Amazon and its people are trying to win back control of the forest that sustains them and convince the world of their worth.
Katie Watson. Finally, scientists at the Natural History Museum here in London have documented a record-breaking 815 new species on the planet over the past year. But you might be surprised to learn that more than 600 of them are a species of wasp, and most of them parasitic. Leda Nathu spoke to the TV presenter and conservationist Chris Packham and asked him if more parasitic wasps are what the world really needs.
Well, yes, they do, because those wasps are primarily parasites, as you say, and they have been used as a form of biological control. So many of these species lay their eggs into the developing larvae of other species, which can be pests. So it's estimated that in the last 50 years or so, using these wasps has benefited millions of reinflated economies and secured livelihoods for lots of people. So understanding and knowing about these creatures can play a productive role in keeping the world a safe place, including a safe place for humans.
So more than 600 new species of wasp, about 800 odd species in total described by the Natural History Museum this year. What were the others?
58 beetles, 4 crabs, some worms that eat whale bones, and the largest penguin that ever lived. So obviously a fossil from 50 million years ago, weighed 150 kilograms, so 3 times the weight of the current largest penguin, the emperor penguin. When we're talking about new species, this is not all people rushing out into remote places across the planet. Some of them are from specimens that have been in museums for years, that have been overlooked. Others are what we call DNA splits. So we think that we've got one species, but developing technology allows us to look a little more carefully at its DNA, and we realise that we've got 2, 3, 4. But this year's been spectacular, I have to say. Electric blue tarantulas from Thailand, pygmy squid from Japan, frogs from Tanzania, tiny chameleons from Tanzania as well. Now, many of the species we've been discussing, very sad to say, are already endangered. The iridescent tarantula from Thailand is losing its habitat. Those frogs and chameleons from Tanzania, deforestation is a problem for those animals as well. We know that more than 1 million species are endangered. So as much as NHM have named 815 new ones this year, we're going to be losing species more quickly than they can name them. But I can tell you, there is still some exciting scientists going out and finding things in the forest. So recently, a new hedgehog species that dwells in the forest of eastern China has been described. They knew that there were these species living there, 4 other known species, but they went out, they found another one, they looked at it, they thought it looked a little bit smaller, its ears were different. Again, DNA came to the rescue when it came to separating them. Across the world, there were 17 known species of hedgehogs, and now there are 18. So there are still things out there to be discovered by the Indiana Joneses of the zoological world.
Chris Packham. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. And as we head towards the new year, we want to hear about stories which are important to you that we can maybe feature on the podcast in 2024. If you have something you think others would be interested in and the BBC could possibly report on, then send us an email with the details. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Ethan Connolly Forster, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nigel Adderley. Until next time, goodbye.